From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The summer season officially begins this weekend. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from the star of several summer movie smashes, including Star Wars and The Fugitive, Harrison Ford. His latest film, Sabrina, is about to come out on video. Tomorrow is the 70th anniversary of the birth of Miles Davis. We'll remember him today with a commentary by Gerald Early, who recently organized a conference on Miles Davis and American culture. And we'll hear an interview with Davis's biographer, Quincy Troupe, about what it was like to become friends with the man who had been his hero. The interview was done by Ira Glass for his new public radio program, This American Life, which we're showcasing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Anti-tobacco activists are turning to state courts today, one day after a federal court ruled all smokers can't be lumped together in one giant class-action lawsuit against cigarette makers. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Now that they've been turned away from federal court, lawyers for smokers will be taking their case to state venues today. Yesterday, a New Orleans federal court panel rejected a huge class action lawsuit that sought to represent all smokers who say they're addicted to cigarettes, potentially tens of millions of people. The so-called Costano case accuses cigarette makers of hiding early knowledge that nicotine was addictive and charges that companies manipulated nicotine levels to hook smokers. The court ruled that a case of such magnitude would be too unwieldy, considering variations in state liability laws. So Costano lawyers are changing tactics. They're filing identical class action lawsuits in almost every state today. Legal observers say state courts are historically more receptive to class litigation. This is Debbie Elliott reporting.
Authorities working at the Everglades ValueJet crash site are cutting back on the number of people they're using. Officials say there were 120 people at the scene, and now there are 80. A hand search is slowly being taken over by a search with heavy machinery. Investigators are still bringing in equipment they'll need to dredge the crater that was dug out by the jet crash. They hope to start this weekend, but it's not clear when they'll be ready. 110 people died in the ValueJet crash, which happened nearly 2 weeks ago. French President Jacques Chirac says he believes the seven French monks kidnapped in Algeria are dead. A militant Islamic group that claimed their abduction 2 months ago says they were beheaded. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President Jacques Chirac released a statement saying that even though the government would like to believe that the monks are alive, it now believes they've been killed. The statement said the forces of hatred and intolerance will never be able to extinguish the flame of respect for others. It noted that the monks had chosen to remain in their isolated monastery south of Algiers, despite the risk of doing so. The area is controlled by Muslim extremists. The most ruthless, the armed Islamic group, faxed a message to a Moroccan radio earlier this week saying it had beheaded the monks because France refused to negotiate. It had demanded the release of one of its leaders from an Algerian jail. France issued another urgent appeal calling on all its citizens in Algeria to come home. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
This is Memorial Day weekend approaching the start of the summer driving season. It is not clear whether higher gas prices will reduce the number of vacationing motorists or not. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 7 1/3 points at 5,769. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up just over a point at 1,249. This is NPR News. Union Pacific Rail officials hope to reopen a major freight rail line today. Officials say a worker mistakenly threw a switch yesterday as a train passed over it. 21 cars derailed near Kearney, Nebraska, and one of the nation's busiest freight lines was shut down. 120 trains use the line every day. Traffic had to be rerouted through Kansas. An engineer was slightly injured. Damage is estimated at more than $900,000. China says it's widening its crime-fighting efforts to include copyright pirates. The United States is threatening to impose severe economic sanctions against China if Beijing doesn't improve its copyright efforts. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Hong Kong.
The official Chinese news agency, Xinhua, today acknowledged that there has recently been a resurgence in the illegal manufacture and sale of pirated software, CDs, and other products. It said the Chinese government is urging police to step up their investigation of factories believed to be producing pirated goods. That's in contrast to earlier Chinese statements that the government is already fully complying with a copyright protection agreement it signed 15 months ago. The U.S. Trade Representative says China could definitely do better and that U.S. businesses lost as much last year to Chinese pirates as they did before the copyright agreement was signed. China has until mid-June to show an improvement in its copyright protection record or face $2 billion in U.S. punitive tariffs. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Hong Kong.
Divers in Lake Victoria are cutting away at a ferry that capsized, drowning hundreds of people. The ship sank Tuesday just off northwest Tanzania. Nearly 550 people drowned. Two divers are taking turns cutting open the ferry's hull. Other divers are retrieving bodies that floated free of the wreck. Passengers accuse the ferry captain of accepting bribes to overload the ship with passengers. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Harrison Ford's acting career was slow to get started, but once it took off, it really took off. He starred in several of America's top 20 grossing films, Star Wars, Return of the Jedi, Raiders of the Lost Ark, The Empire Strikes Back, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He also starred in The Fugitive, Blade Runner, Witness, Patriot Games, and Clear and Present Danger. His remake of the 1954 comedy Sabrina is about to be released on video. Sabrina is the daughter of a chauffeur. They live over the garage on a large estate. She has a crush on the wealthy family's younger son, a playboy named David Larrabee, played by Greg Kinnear. Harrison Ford plays the older son, Linus Larrabee, a business tycoon who's planning a billion-dollar merger with a company whose owner happens to be the father of the woman younger brother David is seeing. In this scene, David storms into Linus's office, accusing Linus of engineering their wedding to facilitate the merger.
Something bothering you, David?
You've been pushing me into this relationship with Elizabeth so you could engineer a merger with Tyson.
Pushing you? I could burn in hell for the lies I told about you. You begged me to make you look good in front of Elizabeth.
You never said a word about planning to make an offer to Patrick.
Talk about my accomplishments, you said. My qualities. Be creative. Lie, you said.
I can't do this, Linus. I'm not ready to make this kind of commitment.
Oh, I see. She must have asked for an actual wedding date.
I don't know what came over me. She was healing children. I was in a tuxedo. I'm not in any position to take care of a wife.
Elizabeth is a doctor and a millionaire, David. She won't be a burden. You don't deserve her, but she appears to love you.
Yeah, see, doesn't that worry you a little bit? I mean, about her mental health?
Although the character Harrison Ford plays does not appear to be a likable guy, the film depends on Sabrina and the audience finding something likable within him. I asked Ford how he fleshed out the character in his mind to make him more sympathetic.
Well, I wanted to deal with the question of Linus's father, who does not appear in the film, and yet must have created circumstances that control Linus's life. Linus runs this large family corporation with his mother and says at one point that he never chose the path he follows, that he does what his father did, and his father did what his father did before him. So I tried to imagine the circumstances of growing up with such a father and in such a world, which all of the effects of which conspire to cause Linus to behave in a manner very similar to his father.
Do you find that comedy uses a different set of muscles as an actor than, say, an action film or a drama does?
I think probably that's fair to say. I suppose it's the small muscle control that makes comedy work.
Exactly.
It's very technical compared to drama, where the effect can happen when it wants to, in a way, in a dramatic scene. You can you have some choices. In comedy, it seems that you have to walk a very narrow path in order to not to upset the joke which is coming. So it is, I find it more technically demanding than drama.
Can you expand on what you mean by technically demanding?
Well, I mean that that this precision with which you must understand how the joke works, and aid the joke rather than get in its way, is something that's a bit more technical than drama.
Now, is it a relief for you to be in a movie where you don't have to be doing stunts and injuring limbs and all of this?
Well, I like all kinds of films. I'm glad to be able to do this kind of film as well as the running, jumping, and falling down kind of movie.
Now, you've described yourself as playing ordinary men who do extraordinary things in extenuating circumstances in your action films.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, your action guys, they're not like the muscle guys who scare off the bad guys just by looking at their biceps.
Mm-hmm.
Your action guys are, an anthropologist in Indiana Jones, a pilot in Star Wars, a CIA guy in the Tom Clancy adaptations, a doctor in The Fugitive. These are not men who were, like, born to be action heroes, but that action role is, they're placed in that action role.
Yeah.
Does that make you more, obviously, you don't have the body to be Arnold Schwarzenegger's kind of action hero.
Sweet of you to mention.
Right.
I don't. That doesn't interest me as much
right.
as it does interest me to see a character that rises to the occasion, a character with real fears and concerns. I think the thing that's missing from many action films is an emotional relationship between the character and the audience. If there is that, if that emotion is there, the kinetic effects can afford to be smaller so as not to lose a certain human scale. The audience is willing to follow that character into the midst of the action, and they stay with the character rather than being so absorbed by the action, so that they feel the danger. They feel the triumph when the character prevails.
Now, you've done a lot of your stunts for your action films. Why do them yourself?
Well, I don't do stunts. I do those things that are reasonable for me to do. Stunts are done by stunt people.
That's a relief. I'd read you'd done them yourself, and I thought, he's
crazy.
Well,
it depends on what you want to call a stunt.
Uh-huh.
I mean, any place you see my face, that's me. If you don't see my face, it ain't me. But I think it's really important, even in the midst of action sequences, for the audience to be to be able to see the character, see his eyes, see whatever emotional expression you're giving them. And so I do try and do as much of the physical action as I can.
Now, I know you got your start in the 1960s in young talent programs at Columbia and Universal Studios.
Mm.
Were you being groomed for a certain type of role?
I think if they could have figured out what kind of role I might be appropriate for, they might have tried to groom me for it. But I think they had very little use for me at all. I was hired for $150 a week. And I don't think anybody had very much hope for me. I don't to this day know why they signed me up at even that paltry sum.
How did you get in?
I was doing a play in Laguna Beach, and John Brown's Body, and a man who was doing the music for us, a fellow named Ian Bernard, sent me up to Columbia Pictures to meet somebody in the casting department. And about 6 months later, after various machinations, I was under contract, 7-year contract, starting at $150 a week.
7 years is a long time.
If I had lasted, I would have made $1,200 a week at the end of it.
So you didn't last. They got rid of you. You walked
they
out?
Got rid of me after a year and a half. But I was I had been making it difficult for them, I think.
How?
I was not a happy puppy.
What were you doing to make their jobs difficult?
Well, I wasn't following the form, as far as they were concerned. I wasn't very accepting of their advice, which was to groom myself like... they wanted me to look like Elvis Presley for some reason.
Which Elvis? The Vegas Elvis? The Sun Years Elvis?
I suppose the Sun Years Elvis, yeah. But that's all the notion they had of me, and I resisted being forced into a mold of someone else's success.
Did you have to change your hair to have, like, an Elvis pompadour?
They sent me to the studio barber for an Elvis pompadour. No, it was a very uncomfortable time for me.
So the studio showed you the door.
They did. They did. My contract was at their option in the first 4 6-month periods. The head of the studio had forgotten to sign my option before he left for Europe, and I was called into his second's office and told that they would they'd carry me for another couple of weeks, since they knew I had a child on the way, but that they were going to recommend that I be dropped when the head of the studio came back. I allowed as how I wasn't very happy there, and I would be quite satisfied to leave right then. Thinking me ungenerous, they did let me go right away. Not ungenerous, thinking me...
ungrateful?
Ungrateful, yeah. They let me go right away.
Did they give you a reason why they weren't satisfied?
No, I think it was clear to both of us that that we weren't getting along.
Mm-hmm. So what was your next step?
Well, by the time the head of that studio came back, it was Columbia Pictures from Europe, I was under contract to Universal for $250 a week.
Was it any better?
Not much, although I enjoyed a better relationship with the people that I worked with. There still was very little work for me.
So how long did that last at Universal?
A year and a half.
And they didn't renew?
That seemed to be the limit of of patience with me at that time.
And did you think, well, that's it? Goodbye acting career?
Not at all. I launched into freelance work in television, which was all I could get at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I freelanced for about 4 years before I began my second career.
Which is as a carpenter.
That's right, yeah.
Now, from what I've read about you as a carpenter is that you basically learned on your job. You hired yourself as a freelancer,
right?
And learned as you worked.
Well, the first job I had was a $100,000 recording studio for Sergio Mendez in his backyard in Encino. That was quite a lot of money at that time.
This is Sergio Mendez of Brazil 66.
Indeed, and he simply forgot to ask me if I had ever done it before.
Obviously, he didn't check your references either.
Right. Well, I didn't have any.
Well, this is where acting can really come in handy, I figure. I mean, did you have to bluff your way through that and be much more confident than you really were?
No, I don't know why I was confident, but I had a couple of good carpenters working for me, and I didn't lack confidence in that area.
So were you actually there with the nails, or were you directing other people?
No. I was there with nails, a hammer, and a book from the Encino Public Library.
So what was the transition back into acting from carpentry?
Well, I did, during the period of time that I was doing carpentry, I also did three films, or two films and a television special. And during that period of time, these jobs became better. Each job was a better job than the one before. And finally, I... George Lucas cast me in Star Wars, and that was really the end of my carpentry career.
Now, which came first, Star Wars or American Graffiti?
American Graffiti was one of the three films that I did while I was carpenting.
Oh. Did that help you a lot?
Well, helped me a lot in my career.
Yeah, and getting noticed, and also maybe finding a film that you felt, I don't know, more comfortable in or more...
Well, I had a very good experience working on American Graffiti. I had the first time that somebody let me work collaboratively. So I felt more comfortable with American Graffiti than I had previous to that time.
Was it the first time you'd worked with a director who was of your generation?
It was. That's very perceptive.
Did that make a difference in terms of seeing things eye to eye?
I think it did make a big difference.
My guest is Harrison Ford. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harrison Ford. Did you relate to the story in American Graffiti? Did you have that kind of high school life of, you know, dating and not being sure if you wanted to go to college and, you know, pranks and stuff like that?
Well, I related to my character's story.
Your character was the real outsider in the film.
Yes, he was. He was the one not even considering going to college. It was his story that I related to. As audience, I related to the film overall when I later saw it, but my job was simply to tell the story through that character.
You went to college?
I did. Yes, I went to college. I went to college for 4 years and flunked out just before graduation.
Oh, you flunked out?
How, I did.
What did... What was the last straw?
there were quite a few last straws. My senior year was a real fiasco, and I think I flunked 3 courses.
So you're getting pretty accustomed to failure, weren't you?
It's a way of life.
Yeah. Was this considered an attitude problem as opposed to a problem of intellect?
Yes. Yes, it was. And I can't argue with it. I did have a very hard time relating to some notion of how this college experience might lead to some focus in life. Everyone else in my classes were going to go on to a professional career. And I couldn't imagine it. I just I didn't want to sit in the same office and do the same job for 20 years.
No, what? Did you know you wanted to act?
No. No, I didn't until my senior year. And that's...
In college?
Yeah. That's when I started doing plays.
So did you stumble into that? Were you reluctantly recruited?
Well, I took an acting class, which I thought would help get my grade point average up. And... not knowing that one was required to perform in the acting class. Actually, it was a drama class. It wasn't an acting class. And so I got up on stage and had to perform, and it made me extremely nervous. My knees were knocking. And that made me... angry not to have control over that kind of thing. So I worked on controlling my fear at first. And then I got interested in the real business of acting, which is storytelling.
Had you ever been deep into fiction, novels?
Well, I'd read a lot, but mostly nonfiction at that point.
Mm-hmm. Were you deep into movies?
No. No, I wasn't much of a movie fan.
So it wasn't really about watching movies, it was about acting?
Yeah, it was about... finding a use for myself as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get back to Star Wars. How did you get cast in Star Wars?
George Lucas asked me to come in help him audition other actors for the parts of Princess Leia and Luke Skywalker. And I did for about 3 or 4 days. Read with hundreds, as I remember, of different actors. And never knowing whether I was actually auditioning myself or not. And finally, George had two different ensembles, two groups of three characters, and chose the group I was a part of finally.
After flunking out of college and then, you know, leaving Universal and Columbia Studios, was the success of Star Wars a real shock to you?
No, I think getting cast in it was a real shock. But as we began to see pieces of the film as we made it and the effects shots as they were being developed, I had a sense that we were in something pretty unique.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I thought it had a pretty good chance.
I'd like to ask you something that I've asked a lot of actresses on the show. You know, actresses are always complaining now that once you reach, I don't know, say your mid-30s, it's so hard to get a leading role or even a decent role in a film. If you don't mind my mentioning your age, you're about 53 now?
53 now, yes.
And are there any similar pressures for men? I mean, you're doing good.
I don't know. I suppose there the pressures are there.
It does seem it's easier for men.
Well, it's easier for men to play their age.
Right.
It's,
exactly.
It's more.
And to be considered attractive and romantic at that age.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that I can accept the blame for that.
Oh, I'm not blaming the men.
No, no,
I mean, I'm not blaming the actors. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I'm not saying you're attractive.
Good.
Yeah.
No, but I don't know why that works the way it does. I think it's a reflection of the way things are in society,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily an invention of the movie business.
So do you feel like I would imagine you'd feel that you have access to the kind of roles that you want.
I do. I'm very lucky right now,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Harrison Ford recorded last December. His film Sabrina comes out on video in a couple of weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'll play it and tell you what it is later.
Coming up, we commemorate the 70th anniversary of the birth of Miles Davis with his biographer, Quincy Troupe. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow marks the 70th anniversary of the birth of jazz trumpeter Miles Davis. He died in 1991. Born in Alton, Illinois, and reared in East St. Louis, Davis became one of the most influential players in the history of jazz. Writer and teacher Gerald Early recently organized a conference at Washington University in St. Louis on Miles Davis and American culture. He has these thoughts.
He was called the Prince of Darkness, Peck's bad boy of jazz, the man with the horn. For me, jazz trumpeter Miles Davis was the greatest genius of jazz in the post-World War II era. For others, he was merely a talent who sold out, someone who betrayed the tradition. In 1970, he decided to play electric, rock-inspired jazz in front of spaced-out kids at big rock festivals in places like the Fillmore East and West. He had been the leader of the most successful small jazz bands in history. Kind of Blue, considered the best small group jazz record ever made, mesmerized me as a teenager. With collaborator Gil Evans, he had made some of the best orchestral jazz outside of Ellington. But he left that behind, going on to play a kind of mixture of avant-garde jazz, acid rock, funk, Stockhausen, and hip-hop until his death in 1991. Some thought this fusion music was adventuresome, and so did I. But others thought it horrible and grotesque. Still others thought it boring. He never looked back. "I have to change," Miles Davis said. "It's like a curse." He was known for having a foul mouth and a foul temper. He turned his back on his audiences and often snapped at admirers. Yet for most of his career, he was among the few band leaders who really cared about both his musicians and his music. Unlike most jazz musicians, Miles Davis died playing music that was totally different from what he did in his prime. He wasn't a jazz snob. In fact, as he grew older, he rarely listened to it except for his beloved Ahmad Jamal. Hardly any jazz musician has ever been such a source of controversy. Not even such atonal players as Cecil Taylor, Ornette Coleman, or Sun Ra. No jazz musician ever has so many supporters and detractors at the same time. Miles Davis was a man of contradictions. He was very race conscious. Some might call him a race man. Yet some of his most impressive records from the beginning of his career were done in collaboration with white musicians. He always tried to give the appearance of youth and vigor, yet he suffered terrible health for most of his life. He loved to box, yet one punch in the mouth could have ended his career. He wanted to take care of himself, yet he was incredibly reckless. Whatever demons drove Miles Davis, few musicians ever covered as much ground or made as many first-rate recordings or worked harder at sustaining their reputations as demanding craftsmen. He wasn't afraid of the influence of his sidemen. His legacy is almost that of modern jazz itself. When Wynton Marsalis first emerged, his music sounded like Miles Davis's 1960s band. Indeed, Marsalis made records with that band's rhythm section, pianist Herbie Hancock, bassist Ron Carter, and drummer Tony Williams. Trumpeter Wallace Rooney is an unabashed disciple, and trumpeter Roy Hargrove tries to emulate Davis's cool demeanor. No trumpeter playing a ballad with a Harmon mute can avoid sounding like Davis. No standard jazz quintet can play without echoes of his presence on the bandstand. No fusion band could exist without his concepts. Like Whitman, Davis contained multitudes. Like Emerson, he raised himself from American soil. Like Ellington, he understood the elasticity of style. Like William Carlos Williams, he rebelled against tradition without forgetting it. Intense, compulsive, inspired, yet self-destructive and vulnerable, he invented and transcended his own American selves. He was an original.
Gerald Early teaches English and directs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington University.
Thank you.
Coming up, Miles Davis's biographer. This is Fresh Air. To continue our Miles Davis birthday commemoration, we're going to showcase a new public radio program. We have an excerpt of This American Life, hosted and produced by Ira Glass at WBEZ in Chicago. Ira is probably best known to NPR listeners from his series of reports on All Things Considered, in which he followed students at Chicago's Taft High School and Washington Irving Elementary School. He also produces the morning edition commentaries by David Sedaris, including the story of working as one of Santa's elves in Macy's department store at Christmas. This American Life has been a popular show on WBEZ in Chicago for several months. Listeners outside of Chicago will have a chance to hear it beginning in June when the program goes national. It features monologues, documentaries, and original works for radio. We think it's an exciting program because it's finding original and absorbing ways of telling personal stories on the radio. Each week, Ira explores a different theme: immigrant parents, the drama bug, people who live secret double lives, chickens and turkeys, or hero worship. And that's what brings us to Miles Davis.
Here's a question we had. What if you idolize someone from afar, and then somehow, over the course of your life, you manage to actually get close to them? You know, actually become their friend. What happens to the romantic dream that you had of them? Well, this is what happened to writer Quincy Troop with Miles Davis. Troop first heard of Miles Davis back when Troop was just a teenager in East St. Louis. And one of the things that was appealing about Miles Davis was the fact that he also was from East St. Louis and had managed to get out, escaped to New York City. Troop, when he first heard Davis's music, was going to a nearly all-white high school. And as he'll be the first to tell you, he was looking for a way to be hip.
I was in a fish fry place, and I saw these four black guys sitting in this booth eating Jack Salmon sandwiches and dinners with dark glasses on and hats, and their hair was conked and everything. So I thought they looked pretty hip. So I went and got my sandwich and sat behind them. And at that time, they were talking about this homeboy from East St. Louis, and he was in New York City, and he was doing all these great things and playing all this great music, and had played with Charlie Parker, who I didn't know any of this. And they said, Miles Dewey Davis, Miles Davis, you know, his name is Miles Davis. And they went up to the record player and put in some money and played Donna Lee. And I remember listening to Donna Lee, and I said, wow, I hadn't liked jazz up until that point. I was about 14 to 15 years old. You know, I was into Johnny Ace and Chuck Berry and, I mean, that kind of music, rhythm and blues. And when I heard this music, for some reason, they played it twice. And the second time, it kind of went straight to my heart. I don't know, I can't explain why it went straight to my heart, but I kind of loved the music. And I sat there, and they sat there for about an hour, and then they left. And when they left, I remember going up to the record player, and I had about 30 cents or something. It was a nickel to play those records. And I went up there, flipped through all those names, and found Miles Davis's name, and played Donna Lee. And I played Donna Lee, then I played another one. That's when I first heard Miles Davis, and then after that, my cousin told me how hip he was and showed me pictures of him and how clean he was. I started seeing how well he dressed and what great style he had.
How clean he was.
Yeah. You know, we used to say he was clean as a broke dick dog, you know, which was a saying that came out of St. Louis, you know. And so I said, wow, this is a guy that I really love. So I started really listening to his music at that time, and it kind of changed my life. And then I found some other friends who had been listening to him for a while, and I kind of left my other friends and started listening to Miles and hanging out with them. And we used to sit up in the stands at Sumner High School and say we were going to run away to New York and be like Miles Davis. So So I remember the first time he came to St. Louis, and it was all this big buzz about him coming to play there. And I doctored up my my draft card and changed all the dates and everything so I could be old enough to get into the club. And I remember going to the pawn shop and getting these great suits and these church's shoes, which were too small for my feet. You know, they were those really hip English shoes. And I had these big Chesterfield hats, and I was really clean. So, but my feet hurt. My feet hurt because the shoes are too small. The shoes are too small. So I go to Peacock Alley with some friends of mine, and we get in. The guy looked at me and said, "Are you really?" Because I was really young looking, but he let me in finally. Let's let me in. And when that band hit, they were so fantastic. They were so fantastic. Miles was so clean. He was so clean and so hip that I was just mesmerized. And so I told my cousin who went with us that I wanted to go up and say hello to Miles and tell him how much I love his music. And so my cousin said, "Quincy, don't go up and say nothing to Miles because Miles doesn't talk to people. He doesn't like people to come up to him and talk to him. So don't go up to him and say anything. Just kind of look at him from a distance." So we kind of stood back and looked at him from a distance. All of us, it was a whole bunch of us, young guys and older guys. We had our glasses and everything on like he had his glasses on. And we kind of looked at him standing at the bar smoking a cigarette, drinking a cognac. And from behind us someplace, I heard this voice said, "Oh, darling, there's Miles Davis." And I turned around and it was this white guy with his girlfriend. And I said, "Wow, what is he going to do?" He said, "Let's go up and say hello." So he walked through us. Excuse me. He walked up to Miles Davis, who was standing at the bar with Coltrane and all the people. He said, "Hi, Miles. How are you?" And Miles said in that gruff voice, "F you. Get out of my face." Like that. And I was like, wow. That was stunning. You know what I mean? I had never heard anybody talk to anyone like that, less long an African-American man say that to a white guy, you know, and I just said to myself, man, this is something.
Now, when was the first time you met Miles as an adult, kind of as the person who you are now?
Yes, I was living in New York, and my friend, Leo Maitland, who is now deceased, was a doctor. And he was Miles' doctor. And he used to always say to me, "You know, I know Miles Davis." I said, You got to introduce me to Miles. So one day he said, "I'm going to have this party." And I said, "Okay, you want to come?" I said, "Yeah." So I go to the party. And I walk in and I'm sitting around and near this great apartment. And I look over in the corner and there's Miles Davis. I said, "My God, Miles Davis." And it was nobody sitting next to him. His was the only seat in the house with nobody sitting next to him. So I went and got some food, and I looked around, no place to sit, and went into another room, wasn't no place to sit. I came back, there was this seat. So I said, I went and sat next to Miles. So I remember him saying something like, "How you doing?" I said, "Hi, all right." "Yeah, you sure?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "You see anything good in here?" I say, "What?" "Anything, man. I'm talking about, do you see anything good?" And I said, "There's some nice ladies in there." "That's right. That's right, you got a good eye." So I said, "Yeah, I love your music." "I don't want to talk about my music. I don't want to talk about it." I said, "Okay." So then we had this general conversation. And then he went and got some food, came back, said to me, "Later." And he left. So about 2 weeks later, I was walking down.
Wait, can we just hold on that part of the conversation?
Sure.
Was this a kind of nervous moment for you? I mean, you're sitting there next to Miles Davis. What was your feeling during this conversation?
I was totally up for it. I had no fear in talking to him. I guess maybe because I was, by this time, I was starting to get a little play myself as a writer in New York, you know. I was starting to get some ink, and I had a kind of feeling about myself at that point. And so it was funny. We just kind of had this exchange, you know. And then when he got ready to leave, he just left, you know. He just left, but he came over to me and said, "Later." So I thought it was some kind of indication of that he was, you know, he liked the conversation or whatever. And so about 3 weeks later, I was walking down Broadway. And here he comes walking straight towards me. And I said, "Oh, that's Miles Davis." So when he got up next to me, I said, "Hey, Miles, how you doing?" He walked right by me, like I didn't even exist. Like I wasn't even on the planet, you know? I mean, he didn't even nod or nothing. He just walked right by me. And I stopped. I remember stopping, and I kind of looked back and said, "Wow, was that Miles Davis?" And it was. I said, "Yeah, that's him." But he didn't speak. I said, "Hey, Miles," and he didn't even turn around, you know? He just kept going. So I said, "Wow, that was kind of cold," you know? I mean, that was kind of cold. It was like I had never experienced that before in my life. And so when I got to know him, you know, I finally got to know him real well when I did the Spin magazine. I did a piece, a two-part piece for Spin magazine. And when I walked in his place, he looked at me and he kind of said, yeah, sit down. So I sit down and I remember him reaching out with his hand to grab my dreadlocks. And I hit his hand, pow! And he said, what are you, crazy? What are you, crazy, hit me like that? I said, no, man. I said, you know, because I'm over here to interview you, doesn't mean that you have the right to invade my space. I said, plus the other times that I tried to talk to you, you just shined me on. He said, oh, you mean the time out on the street? The time out on the street? I said, yeah. He said, man, I don't have to talk to you, man. I didn't have to talk to you. What you got to talk about this time? And that's the way it started. And we got to be the best of friends, I mean, until he died. I mean, you know, but it was, you know, Miles was always testing you. He was always testing you. He was the kind of guy, that I loved him because he was always the kind of guy that was always testing you. And if you passed the muster, if you could stand up to him, and then if he liked you, he would bring you in. If you couldn't, he'd just run over you, you know?
Quincy Troupe is Miles Davis's biographer. We'll hear more of Troupe's interview with Ira Glass after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Ira Glass's interview with Quincy Troupe. This is an excerpt of Ira's new public radio program, This American Life.
Quincy Troupe spent 3 years collaborating with Miles Davis on Davis's autobiography, talking to Davis and interviewing him actually until Davis got sick of being interviewed. To create a book written in Miles's voice and syntax, it sold over 1 million copies. And if you ask Quincy, when did he stop seeing Miles Davis as the mythic, legendary figure and start seeing him as just another friend, he really can't tell you. It was gradual. One day, he was on the outside of Miles' life, looking in. And then, at some point later, he realized that he was on the inside.
You know, I got very up close with Miles. I was in his pocket, and he was in my pocket for like 2.5, 3 years. I mean, until the time he died. I mean, I was really close to him. And so I saw, you know, flaws in his personality that, you know, because I think when you idolize a person like him, like he was one of my heroes, especially when you're young, you don't think they have flaws. You kind of see them through these rose-tinted glasses, and you kind of look at them as perfect. And so when I started to see some things that was not perfect about Miles, like his way of treating women and his way of treating other people sometimes, and little small things, you know, like cleanliness sometimes.
You know, cleanliness is coming up in this interview a lot more than I ever would have guessed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Miles was a clean person. I mean, in terms of like his body and the way he dressed. But, well, there were a couple of times when I went over his house one day and it was a mess. I mean, stuff was everywhere. Clothes, you know, toothbrush, toothpaste, you know, music, trumpets. And I said, Miles. I said, you're living like a pig, man. I said, you're living like a pig, man. This is a pigsty. He said, so what? So what? So what is a pigsty? What you expect? I just play music, chump. He said, somebody cleans it up. That's the deal. ¶¶ when I would see some of that, and first I would say, man, this guy could be a pig, you know? But then I got to the point where I said, no, he's just a human being. He's a human being. He has flaws. He plays beautiful music. But he had these little areas where, you know, he was just a human being, where he was flawed. Like, I never thought Miles would be as country as he was. You know, what I mean by country, I mean country, like a southern, you know, instead of a jazz musician, when you got to know Miles, like some elegant jazz musician, you know, Miles was like a country blues singer.
When was it that you first saw that side of him really clearly?
When I was doing the book and I was about 3 or 4 months in, when he started dropping the mask, you know, and he just dropped the mask and I'd come by and he'd have food and, you know, he'd cook for me and we'd look at boxing matches and look at the basketball games. And at first, when I would go over there, he would always be dressed elegantly, you know, and very fashionable stuff. And then after that, he started dressing just really casually, and especially on the West Coast. When I'd go up there, he'd have on blue jeans, a torn sweater, you know, and he would just cook. And we'd just sit there and look and tell lies, and he'd listen to the fights, and we'd go for long walks on the beach, and he'd take me for rides in his car. So it was just a beautiful kind of relationship. But as a matter of fact, I told him, I said, you know, when you're in California, you're much different than you are in New York. And he said, yeah. After a while, he acknowledged that. He said, yeah, because in New York, I got to keep my mask up. I said, yeah, that's right. You got to keep it up.
When did you first figure out about the way he was treating women? When did you first figure out that he was kind of abusive?
Well, when I started to hear some of the stories, because, you know, Miles was brutally honest. He was brutally honest when he did that book. He told me, I remember he was telling me the stories of him beating up these women and chasing his wife around the basement of their house and you know, with a knife and a gun. And, you know, so I started to think to myself, wow, this is out, you know. I mean, this is a strange kind of situation because I'm just the opposite. I don't believe in hitting women. You know, I don't believe in hitting anybody, you know, like that. But I figured out that Miles Davis was the kind of person, he wasn't an intellectual where he could respond and talk it out, you know, talk the whole thing through. So if you got up in his faith, whether you were a man or a woman, you know, he would hit you. That was the way he was, you know? I mean, he would hit you. I can be truthful and say I didn't like the way he did certain things, you know? But then at the same time, we who knew him really well knew that he was a warm and generous person to us, you know? And we'd look at those things and say, hey, man, that was kind of cold what he did there. But, you know, I mean, the way I looked at it, I'd say, well, you know, that's between him and that person, you know? I never saw him hit a woman in front of me. Because you got to remember, I knew him from 1985 until he died, which was a period of 6 years. And so when he was in his most desperately insane period of really doing these kind of things to women, this was from 1968 to 1980, 12 years. And I didn't know him then, so I never saw that, you know.
Would there be occasional moments sometimes once you got to be friends with him where it would suddenly strike you, man, I'm friends with Miles Davis?
What it generally happened was when somebody would come up to me and say to me, man, what is it like to be with Miles Davis? You know, I always wanted to be with Miles Davis. And then I would think, whoa. But for me, after it got to a certain level, you know, I never thought about it because, you know, we had just had this natural relationship. He'd call me up or I'd call him up. I remember telling somebody one time, Miles called me up from Japan. He had just taped this new thing. And he said, what you think of this? And he put it on. And he played for about 5 minutes, and he said, what you think? And I would tell him whether I liked it or I didn't. If I didn't like it, I'd tell him I didn't like it. And I was relating this to somebody, and they said, you mean Miles Davis calls you up and puts on the tape, and you listen to it? And I said, yeah. He said, well, what's that like? I said, man, I guess it's like any one of my friends who's a poet, you know, who will say, listen to this poem, you know what I mean? Just so happens it's Miles Davis's music, and he happens to be internationally famous.
Many public figures, up close, lose the larger-than-life quality that they seem to have from afar. But there's something about Miles Davis that even today, even though Quincy Troup was as close to Miles Davis as he's ever been to anybody in his life, that even today, it's easy for Quincy to see Miles as this mythic figure. He says Miles just had this effect on people.
I remember one time it was like I was with him. I can't remember the Japanese, not Miyashi, but it was another Japanese designer. And he had his clothes in New York. And he had his clothes, and he had Andy Warhol, before Andy Warhol died, and Miles Davis modeling as the star models of the clothes, along with all these beautiful, gorgeous women. So Miles called me and said, "You want to go down with me?" I said, "Yeah, I'll go with you." So we go in this place called The Tunnel. It was some kind of a discotheque. So we're in there, and they're modeling the clothes, and everybody's going out. Miles would walk out, Andy Warhol would walk out. So I'm backstage. And with Andy and you know, these are two legends. You know, these are two American icons in culture. So Miles was the finale. And he had this outfit with this gold lamé cape that he was supposed to walk out with a hat. So he started to walk out, and Andy was standing there looking at him. And the cape was dragging on the floor. So he started to walk out. He turned around and looked at Andy Warhol. And he said to Andy, "Andy, pick up that cape." So Andy picked up the cape. And they walked out together, you know what I mean? Like, and Andy had this sheepish look on his face. And Miles strutted out, and Andy was holding the cape off the floor. And they walked up the thing. And so everybody in the room, they left us in the room. Andy's handlers, they were like shocked. They had never heard anything like that. They were like, "Wow, did you see that? Did you see that?" But Andy was smiling. He was like happy to be in it. He was like happy to be in it. And so that was Miles. You know, Miles Davis was like almost like a king. You know what I mean? He was like a king. And so that particular moment, I remember him saying, I remember his attitude was like, "I'm the king here. Pick up the cape." You know, we both might be icons, but I'm a bigger icon than you.
Quincy Troup co-authored Miles Davis's autobiography, Miles. He's a poet and journalist and essayist and author of several books. His latest is called Avalanche from Coffeehouse Press. I'm Ira Glass.